Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the February 17th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week has what looks like Winnie the Pooh, but instead of Pooh's head, it is the head of Xi Jinping of China. He's hanging on to a balloon, and he is floated up in the air trying to get to the beehive for the honey I guess Pooh would have been doing. But the bees have popped the balloon, and it is leaking air. He's got a concerned look on his face, and the headline is, "Foiled, What China's Balloon Fiasco Has Revealed." And that is our first main story. We'll start with that. U.S. analyzing China's downed spy balloon. What happened? Questions swirled this week around a suspected Chinese surveillance balloon that was shot down by the U.S. military off the coast of South Carolina after it spent days drifting over the U.S., riveting public attention. Tensions between the superpowers flared after the giant white balloon was seen floating over Montana at about 60,000 feet, and U.S. officials acknowledged they'd been quietly tracking it as it crossed Alaska, Canada, and Idaho. As it passed over Kansas and Missouri, Chinese officials admitted that the craft, estimated to be 200 feet tall and carrying 2,000 pounds of equipment, was theirs, but said it was a weather balloon that had blown off course. U.S. officials rejected that claim, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken canceled a trip to China, calling the balloon flight a violation of our sovereignty. After waiting for the balloon to pass beyond land, the military shot it down off the coast of South Carolina with a missile from an F-22 fighter jet, and the burst balloon fluttered down to the sea. There, its contents were being recovered by the Navy. Republicans assailed President Biden over his response, saying the balloon should have been downed as soon as it was detected. Allowing its flight over the U.S. was an embarrassing display of weakness, said House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McCaul. The administration countered that shooting it down sooner would have created debris endangering people on the ground, and that waiting until it was over water would allow for better recovery of the craft. Officials also said that at least three such balloons had flown into U.S. airspace near Texas, Florida, and Hawaii during Donald Trump's presidency, though none were detected at the time. Chinese officials said shooting down the balloon was an excessive reaction, calling its flight an isolated, accidental incident. But a senior U.S. official said the craft was a maneuverable and had been deliberately flown over sensitive military sites. The Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence had linked the balloon to a vast surveillance program run by the Chinese military involving many balloons that has gathered information on military capabilities in Japan, India, Taiwan, and numerous countries in five continents. It's a massive effort, one official said. What the editorial said. The furor over the wandering balloon has a certain funny side, said The Guardian, but there's no humor in what it tells us about the jittery state of U.S.-China relations. President Xi Jinping's ultra-nationalist aggression over Taiwan and the South China Sea has backfired badly, alerting democratic neighbors to the Chinese threat and to harden their defenses. But America also has much to lose if Biden heeds the China hawks and allows relations with Beijing to deteriorate further. The public deserves to know more about the episode, said the Wall Street Journal. The Biden administration stood by while a spy craft lurked in our airspace for days, notably near bases for U.S. nuclear missiles in Montana. The incident drives home the vulnerability of the U.S. homeland and ought to pop U.S. illusions that China's behavior is irrelevant to Americans at home. what the columnist said. The balloon drama offered something for everyone, said Charles Sykes in The Bulwark. It had intrigue, alluring visuals, a dollop of slapstick comedy to leaven the frisson of crisis, and a fantastic finish in which the ominous balloon from Beijing was blasted into shredded Kleenex by America's top guns. But as with all dark comedies, questions linger. Were the Chinese testing us with this very visible balloon? What was its real purpose? One possibility is that it really was an error, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. It's also possible that hardline elements in China's military wanted to sabotage the Blinken visit. But now the balloon's intelligence equipment is being recovered and analyzed. This incident may prove of more benefit to the United States than to China. The hysterical GOP response to this fiasco was moronic, said Michael A. Cohen in The New Republic. Whatever limited intelligence the balloon gathered that China's spy satellites could not is more than outweighed by the diplomatic and political embarrassment of getting caught. You can be sure Xi is not happy. The entire episode has been humiliating for China. Elements of high farce aside, the balloon drama threatens to be a watershed moment in the world's dangerous new superpower rivalry, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. As the craft drifted like a UFO above the U.S. heartland, the Chinese threat suddenly was neither distant, theoretical, unseen, nor years in the future. The anger and distrust created by China's brazen intrusion will be manageable in the short term, but the Fuhrer drives home how hard it will be to stop this growing rivalry from hitting a boiling point. And we will read the second main story this week. Upbeat Biden touts victories, booming economy. What happened? Facing an atmosphere of deep partisan division, President Biden this week struck an optimistic tone in a State of the Union speech, widely interpreted as a practice run for a re-election campaign. Biden praised the country's economic recovery during his tenure, including the creation of more than 12 million jobs and an unemployment rate sinking to a 54-year low, as well as the 2021 passage of the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. At least a dozen times when listing legislative accomplishments, he called on Congress to finish the job. He also repeated calls for bipartisan action in areas such as immigration, national security, and antitrust enforcement, and he vowed to veto any attempt at a national abortion ban or a repeal of prescription drug price controls. The people sent us a clear message, he said. Power for the sake of power, conflict for the sake of conflict, gets us nowhere. Biden made multiple proposals, including a $35 price cap on insulin, an assault weapons ban, and curbs on hidden fees that are unlikely to gain traction with the new Republican House majority. Although incoming House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had urged civility, booing erupted repeatedly during the speech. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene shouted, "Liar," when Biden said some Republicans wanted to eliminate Social Security and Medicare. Biden smilingly praised her and other hecklers for their conversion to preserving entitlements. Giving the Republican rebuttal speech, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders warned that Biden had surrendered his presidency to a woke mob that can't even tell you what a woman is. The dividing line in America was no longer between right and left, she said, but between normal or crazy. What the editorial said. That was Biden's most effective public address as president, said the Houston Chronicle. Ditching the teleprompter and appearing loose and at ease, he smartly emphasized his deal-making prowess by citing the 300 bipartisan bills he signed over the past 2 years. Shrewdly, he turned the looming fight over raising the debt ceiling against the GOP by highlighting the unpopular Republican willingness to cut Social Security. It was a mic drop performance full of dynamism, gutsy ad-libs, and cunning wit. Most of America, though, has soured on this president, said the Wall Street Journal. Just 38% of Americans approve of his handling of the economy, and only 16% say they're better off since he took office. Chalk that up to Biden's partisan agenda, which seeks to impose the progressive priorities of radical division and climate alarmism. At this point, a majority of Democrats want someone else to run in 2024. Among all voters, Biden even flunked a hypothetical matchup with former President Trump. What the columnist said. Biden's not so bad at this after all, said Amanda Carpenter in The Bulwark. Some Democrats have openly fretted about reelecting someone who will be 82 starting his second term, but the State of the Union address proved Biden's still got it. He spoke to middle-class concerns, exhorted Republicans to join him, and offered snappy comebacks to the hecklers. He almost seemed to enjoy it, too. Predictably, Biden's folksy stump speech was riddled with various misrepresentations, demagogueries, and fodderall, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. But he'll get a pass because all anyone will remember is the infuriatingly unwitting assistance he received from Green and other jeering Republican backbenchers. Apparently thinking Joe Uli Wilson had the right idea in interrupting President Obama in 2009, they displayed loud and shameful disrespect for the president. On a purely aesthetic level, it worked greatly to his benefit. Yet it wasn't Obama that Biden evoked, but Trump, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Pushing economic populism, Biden made enthusiastic riffs on the idea of the forgotten man neglected by both parties and pushed for tougher Buy American rules, though unlike his predecessor, he threw in support for a new tax on billionaires and education spending. It's a potent mix that fiscal conservatives underestimate at their peril, and it was deftly delivered. Still, however reassuring Democrats found that speech, the campaign trail requires a lot of performances, and our oldest ever president's quest for four more years has a long, long way to go. The controversy of the week, African American Studies, a major victory for DeSantis. The College Board marked the start of Black History Month last week by caving to Ron DeSantis, said Nikki McMahon Ramirez in Rolling Stone. To help build his anti-woke brand, Florida's ambitious governor sent conservatives into swoons of delight when he recently blocked Florida schools from adopting the board's AP African American Studies, APAAS, curriculum as an optional class for college-bound high school seniors, claiming it lacks educational value. Rather than defend the importance of exposing students to an honest, accurate discussion of America's racial history, the College Board meekly folded. Last week, it published a revised Black History curriculum stripped of all the topics, including reparations, intersectionality, and the Black Lives Matter movement, that DeSantis had flagged as objectionable. The board insists the changes had nothing to do with DeSantis' demagoguery, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Even if that's true, the deletions are a grievous error. On the right, there's a growing movement led by DeSantis to cleanse American history of any facts or ideas that might cause white people discomfort. These censors don't want kids taught that 250 years of slavery played an indispensable role in this nation's growth into an economic giant, and that the systemic exploitation and oppression of black people did not end with the Civil War and continues to this day. Black history must be told in full. Conservatives agree, said Ilya Shapiro in the New York Post. If liberals weren't too busy hyperventilating, They might have heard DeSantis explain that he supports the neutral, fact-based teaching of black history, including slavery and Jim Crow. He objected to polarizing and ideological topics in the APAAS curriculum, such as black queer studies, the case for reparations, and the need to abolish all prisons. That progressive propaganda has now been replaced by substantive topics such as the growth of the black middle class. The only scandal here, said Max Eden in City Journal, is that the board tried to present the one-sided vision of far-left academics until it joined DeSantis on the right side of history. DeSantis couldn't be more wrong, said Bess Levin in Vanity Fair. The would-be authoritarian has been signing one absurd law after the next, including his Don't Say Gay bill, which banned elementary school teachers from any mention of homosexuality and gender identity, and the infamous Stop Woke Act, currently stayed by courts, which bans history lessons that might provoke feelings of guilt or anguish among white students. Liberals want to have it both ways, said National Review in an editorial. They accused DeSantis of politicizing public schools and colleges, but they expect schools to impose a left-wing agenda on students. DeSantis is a Republican who won re-election in Florida in a landslide, and he has every right to put his own stamp on public schools. What is good for the goose is good for the gander. So history lessons should be shaped by who won the last election? Asked Nicholas Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. That's crazy. Let educators educate, not politicians. Academic freedom should be the rule. DeSantis and his defenders claim they want to stop indoctrination, but in fact they just want their own version of events to be taught. Students deserve a textured, complicated, multifaceted view of slavery, segregation, racial violence, and all of black history, not one cleansed of uncomfortable truths. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for disgust. After Republican Senator Mitt Romney chastised serial liar Representative George Santos for grinning and shaking hands in the front aisle of the House chamber before the State of the Union speech. You don't belong here, an indignant Romney told him. You ought to be embarrassed. It was a good week for self-esteem. After the rapper and producer Dr. Dre was awarded the first annual Dr. Dre Global Impact Award at the Grammys. Never compromise your vision at all, Dre told the audience, holding the Dr. Dre Award aloft. It was a good week for the quiet life. After Boris Johnson, the disgraced former British Prime Minister, revealed he is spending his days mastering the art of drawing cows, who are actually far more difficult to draw than you think. Next stop, the horse. But it was a bad week for reviews after Canada's CBC News revealed that Le Nouveau Duluth, Montreal's highest-rated restaurant on TripAdvisor, does not exist. TripAdvisor blamed the dozens of ecstatic reviews written as a prank on a failure in human moderation practices. It was a bad week for taking your work home after Jose Ruben Nava Noriega, director of a zoo in Mexico, was accused of having four of the zoo's 10 pygmy goats slaughtered and cooked for a banquet. And finally, it was a bad week for wolf whistles after a fan tweeted that the revealing gown singer Janelle Monáe wore to the Grammys finally showed how fine she is instead of dressing like the Monopoly Man. When thousands of fans responded with likes, an angry Monáe shot back, "No new music just for this, no new tour. Hope it was worth it, beloved." And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. First up, gun laws from the age of muskets. Does a man involved in 5 shooting incidents in 6 weeks and under indictment for assaulting an ex-girlfriend have a constitutional right to own a gun? Asked Ruth Marcus. Sure he does. The uber-conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last week in vacating Texas resident Zaki Rahimi's conviction for illegal gun possession. Rahimi, the court conceded, may not be a model citizen, but despite his frequent misuse of guns and domestic abuse, he is entitled to the Second Amendment's guarantees. This is the insane state of Second Amendment law in the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court's Bruin ruling last year. In striking down New York State's licensing standards, the court's 6 conservative justices introduced a new history-based standard, a straitjacket, really, to determine the constitutionality of any gun law. All restrictions, said the justices, must have some historical analog in obscure colonial-era statutes. Thanks to Bruin, right-wing judges in lower courts are invalidating perfectly sensible gun laws, including those that ban gun ownership for domestic abusers, who all too frequently wind up killing their partners with guns. In the age of muskets, wife beating was not a crime, so it's no longer disqualifying. Harris failure should not be a surprise. No one wanted the first woman vice president to be mediocre or a flop, said Jim Garrity. But Kamala Harris has faded into irrelevance rather than blossoming into a star and likely successor to Joe Biden. And Democrats should have seen it coming. Harris was chosen only because an old white male, Biden, had to check his party's identity box by promising to pick a woman of color as his vice president. He chose Harris despite her flailing performances in the 2020 presidential debates and primaries, and reports of dysfunction and chaos on her campaign staff. Biden's close advisors vehemently opposed her selection. Biden could have kept his promise by picking former Obama advisor Susan Rice, California Representative Karen Bass, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, or Florida Representative Val Demings, but they lacked national name recognition. So Biden and the Democrats succumbed to wishful thinking, portraying the California senator as sharp, decisive, bold, a gifted orator who'd lead the party into a multicultural future. Nearly 3 years later, Harris remains incoherent, ineffective, and highly unpopular, and Biden has sidelined her into attending funerals and ribbon cuttings. There is no better version of Harris waiting to be unveiled. This column comes from Japan. Party ties with Moonies run deep. Japan is in an uproar over the ruling party's ties with a foreign cult, said Makihara Izuru. Most Japanese didn't realize the extent of the links between the Unification Church and the Liberal Democratic Party until the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe last year. Abe's killer, Tetsuya Yamagami, blamed the church for his family's bankruptcy after his mother gave it her entire fortune. He channeled his rage at Abe because Abe was rumored to be close to the church. Now it turns out Abe's party's involvement with the church was extensive and alarming. The Unification Church, founded by South Korea's Sun Myung-moon, is not only a predatory and fraudulent outfit extorting money from its members, but also a fundamentally anti-Japanese organization. Moon, after all, preached that Japan should atone for its past sins by serving Korea. Abe's Japanese Nationalist Party should have rejected such a doctrine outright. But instead, it's been working with the cult for decades. The government seems to think that simply ordering lawmakers to cut ties with the church will end the scandal. But it will take much more than that. Any lawmaker found to have Moony connections must be expelled, and the church itself must be banned. And we'll move on to our feature article, The Last Word, titled this week, A War Against Love. India's ruling party is trying to stamp out interfaith marriages, accusing Muslims of a love jihad to convert Hindu women, said Zanara Baksh in Kota Story. A few brave couples are defying the bans. In India, the last 2 months of 2022 were dominated by lurid media coverage of the deaths of two women. One of the women, Shadra Walker, was murdered by her boyfriend in Delhi. Her body had allegedly been cut up into 35 pieces, stored in a refrigerator, and gradually disposed of in a forest. Walker's father reported her missing after her friend said her cell phone had been switched off for months. She had been murdered in May. Her boyfriend was arrested in November and is currently in judicial custody. The second woman, Tunisha Sharma, a 20-year-old actor, allegedly hung herself on December 24th on the set of a TV show that she was working on with her boyfriend. They had apparently broken up shortly before her death. After Sharma's death, her boyfriend was arrested for abetment to suicide. What links the otherwise unconnected deaths of these two young women is that they were Hindu and their boyfriends were Muslim. Predictably, both cases were reported in the mainstream Indian media, particularly on television, as examples of love jihad, a right-wing conspiracy theory alleging that vulnerable Hindu women are being groomed by Muslim men and converted to Islam. Asif Khan, a resident of Dindori in the Indian state of Madhya Pradesh, married Sashki Sahu in April. They were in their early 20s. As the news spread through their village of a Muslim man marrying a Hindu woman, local Hindutva, or Hindu nationalist groups, mobilized to rescue Sakshi. The law was on the side of the vigilantes. The police booked Asif for wrongful confinement and kidnapping, based on a complaint by Sakshi's brother. A local unit of the BJP, India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, blocked a nearby highway to protest the marriage, and the district administration demolished Asif's family home and three shops they owned. Still, the couple refused to break up, leaving their village to live a quieter married life elsewhere. But news of Walker's murder and the associated national talk of love jihad reintroduced stresses and fears into their marriage. "We have been reassuring Sakshi that she doesn't need to be afraid," Asif's father, Halim Khan, told me. "But she is scared." Asif told me that he had told Sakshi that society would never accept their relationship, but that she had said she would throw herself in front of a train if they broke up because of their religion. But the anger evident in the media coverage of Walker's death shook the couple. Asif told Sakshi that she is not a captive, that she can go back to her parents if she wants. According to Charu Gupta, a history professor at Delhi University, love jihad produces a master narrative of Muslim male aggression and a Hindu woman's seizure. This, she wrote, is critically linked to the fictive demographic fear of Hindus being outnumbered by others, which is central to Hindutva politics and makes it possible for a still overwhelming majority that controls all the levers of power to portray itself as an endangered minority. Several politicians from the BJP have referred to the deaths of Walker and Sharma in terms of love jihad. In Karnataka, the Indian state that contains Bengaluru, a city that is, by some estimates, second only to Silicon Valley as a global hub for tech, a BJP member of parliament began the new year by telling party workers that, when campaigning for local elections scheduled in the spring, they should not speak about minor issues like roads and sewage. Instead, they should impress on voters that if you are worried about your children's future, and if you want to stop love jihad, then we need BJP. To get rid of love jihad, we need BJP. last month, Karnataka's home minister told reporters that he had received a petition from Hindutva groups demanding that a special task force be formed to investigate Love's Jihad. He added that in his view, the state's anti-conversion laws were sufficient to deter and deal with cases of Love's Jihad. Karnataka, governed by the BJP, has so far resisted joining other BJP-governed states, such as Uttar Pradesh, Gujarat, and Madhya Pradesh, in specifically legislating to make interfaith marriage more difficult. In Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state with over 200 million people, the chief minister, a Hindu monk notorious for hate speech, told a crowd in a campaign speech that he would protect the honor and dignity of women from Love's Jihad at any cost. In February 2021, Uttar Pradesh introduced a law that criminalized religious conversion through marriage, deceit, coercion, or enticement. Those found guilty can be imprisoned for up to a decade. And in Madhya Pradesh, which sprawls across the center of India, the chief minister referred to Walker's murder in December at an event to celebrate a local 19th century freedom fighter. The hero was a tribal, a term used in India to refer to ethnic minorities, officially designated in the Indian Constitution as scheduled tribes, who remain some of the most economically underprivileged people in the country. "I will not allow this game of Love's Jihad to continue," the chief minister said. "Someone cheats our daughters in the name of love, marries them, and cuts them into 35 pieces. Such acts will not be allowed in Madhya Pradesh." This, even though Walker was not murdered in the state and was not a tribal. Just over 2% of marriages in India are interfaith, and Love's Jihad clearly appears to be a figment of the imagination. But statements such as these, made by powerful politicians, have put even more pressure on the few people brave enough to enter into interfaith marriages in India. Even before the right-wing Hindu supremacist boogeyman of Love's Jihad became widespread, interfaith relationships in India were rare. Now they are dangerous. In Uttar Pradesh, where you can be imprisoned if the authorities deem your marriage to be one in which the primary motivation was religious conversion, Rashid Khan, a Muslim man, married Pinky, a Hindu woman. They married in 2020, the year that the state's draconian anti-conversion law was formulated, though not yet passed. Pinky told me she knew their future was fraught with danger, but she went ahead and asked for Rashid's phone number anyway. Both Pinky and Rashid worked in Dehradun, a city nestled in the picturesque foothills of the Himalayas, and they grew close over long conversations and stolen moments between shifts. 3 years later, Rashid said he wanted to marry her, and he was willing to marry her according to Hindu custom and ritual. Pinky said she had long been drawn to Islam and wanted to have a Muslim wedding and to convert. On July 24th, their marriage was solemnized in a nikah in Dehradun Mosque. Pinky changed her name to Muskan. Initially, Muskan tried to get her family to accept the marriage, but her mother beat her and threw her out of the house. Still, the early months of the marriage were happy, and soon Muskan was pregnant with their first child. When the couple decided to get their marriage officially recorded in a court in Moradabad, in Uttar Pradesh, where Rashid was from, their petition was noticed by a local unit of the Barjang Dal, a group of Hindutva militants that is part of the broader Sangh Parivar, the Hindutva family that includes the BJP. The couple suspects that their lawyer tipped off the Barjang Dal. Rashid and Muskan were attacked on their way to the courthouse. The mob beat up Rashid and his brother and took them to the police station. Meanwhile, Muskan, who was in the fourth month of her first pregnancy, was severely beaten and dumped outside a government-run shelter for women and children. "I was in trauma and extreme pain. I thought I would never see Rashid again," Muskan told me. adding that there were other women being held at the shelter who were romantically involved with Muslim men. "We were all tortured," she alleged, "made to work, cooking and cleaning continuously. I spent the days crying and in pain." Muskan was eventually moved to a hospital where she said she was injected by a doctor with undisclosed medicines. Shortly after, she suffered a miscarriage and was discharged the next day. When Rashid was brought to court, Muskan said she loved him and that she had married him of her own free will. Her testimony convinced the court to release Rashid. The couple moved back to Dehradun to restart their lives in a single room. "This is the safest place we could find," she told me. They have had a child since the miscarriage, and Muskan is breastfeeding her on the double bed that takes up most of the space in the room. Rashid and his sister, with her husband and son, were also sitting on the same bed. In another corner, a gas stove perched on a table served as the kitchen. Since Narendra Modi swept into office in 2014 and was reelected with an even stronger mandate in 2019, almost every Muslim action is freighted with the word jihad. The mainstream Indian media have used this shorthand with relish. On March 11, 2020, Sudhir Chowdhury, a prominent and popular Indian journalist, presented his viewers with a chart outlining the various kinds of jihad to which India's Hindus were subject. He talked about hard jihad and soft jihad, about the jihad being waged by the media, about the jihad being waged on history, on land rights, on the Indian economy, on affairs of the heart. The media even attempted to pin the spread of COVID in India to a single super spreader event connected to an Islamic conclave in a Delhi neighborhood, labeling it Corona Jihad. Another prominent Indian television journalist described an attempt by Muslims to infiltrate the civil services by passing a nationwide exam as the UPSC Jihad. Muslims are drastically underrepresented in India's civil services, and the number is dwindling, with Muslims making up only 3% of those who qualified to join the services in 2021. Even though Muslims make up an estimated 14% of the population. Meanwhile, the 2021 National Crime Records Bureau, the NCRB, report shows that Muslims comprise more than 30% of India's prison population. Last year, Gregory Stanton, the founder of Genocide Watch, said during a U.S. congressional briefing that Modi was an extremist who has taken over the government. Stanton, a credible and highly respected scholar, said, "We are warning that genocide could very well happen in India." Already drastic, even illegal measures can be taken to punish Muslims for alleged crimes, including bulldozing their homes, breaking up their relationships, and boycotting or shutting down their businesses. In October, Meenakshi Ganguly, the South Asian director at Human Rights Watch, said, "The authorities in several Indian states are carrying out violence against Muslims as a kind of summary punishment. They are sending a message to the public that Muslims can be discriminated against and attacked." But Muskan, who told a court in Uttar Pradesh of her love for Rashid, remains defiant. "Even though they say that Muslim men manipulate Hindu girls," she told me, "it was me who initiated our relationship. I made a choice. They might call it jihad, but people like us won't stop loving each other." This article was originally published by Coda Story. We'll read a few of the health and science articles this week. First up, how being obese is bad for your brain. Obesity can cause changes in the brain similar to those seen in Alzheimer's patients, a new study shows. Scientists have long known that being overweight is a risk factor for Alzheimer's because it can damage the brain's blood vessels and increase the prevalence of plaque that hinders communication between cells. The new research suggests that such neurodegeneration may bring on Alzheimer's earlier, but it also holds out hope that people vulnerable to the disease might be able to slow cognitive decline by losing weight. For the study, researchers at McGill University in Montreal analyzed brain scans of more than 1,300 people in the UK and North America. Roughly a quarter were Alzheimer's patients, and a quarter were obese people, and the remaining half were healthy individuals. They found that the cerebral cortex, responsible for speech, memory, and judgment, had thinned in similar locations among both the Alzheimer's and obese groups, degeneration not seen in the healthy group. We showed that one of the reasons why obesity is such an important risk factor for Alzheimer's disease might be through neurodegeneration, lead author Philip Morris tells the Daily Telegraph. Our results highlight the importance of decreasing weight in obese and overweight individuals in midlife to decrease the subsequent risk of neurodegeneration and dementia. Return of the dodo. The expression "dead as a dodo" may soon be obsolete. The gene editing company that made headlines with plans to bring back the woolly mammoth now wants to do the same for the dodo. The flightless bird went extinct in the 17th century, less than 100 years after Portuguese sailors first arrived on its native island of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. About 3 feet tall and weighing up to 44 pounds, dodos had the evolutionary misfortune of having no natural predators and therefore no instinctive fear. Humans killed them for food, while rats and pigs brought on the ships ate their eggs. The team at Colossal Biosciences has managed to reconstruct the dodo's genome, but bringing the species back to life won't be easy. They will attempt to edit the genome of its most closely related living species, the Nicobar pigeon, so that it resembles that of a dodo, then implant new genes into an egg cell and allow it to develop. The goal will be to rewild the new dodo on Mauritius with the help of local conservationists. Bess Shapiro, lead paleogeneticist at Colossal, says the science developed for the project will aid in preserving modern species as well. We could have picked lots of different birds, she tells Scientific American. I happen to really love the dodo. Booster is still working. Bivalent COVID booster shots cut the risk of getting the virus by about half, new research has found, even with infections caused by the fast-spreading XBB.1.5 subvariant. In the first major study on the efficacy of the inoculations, researchers at the Centers for Disease Control looked at nearly 30,000 test results from across the country between December 1st and January 13th. They found that for adults up to age 49, the boosters cut the odds of getting symptomatic infection from the BA5 subvariant by 52% and from the XBB or XBB15 strains by 49%. Among those ages 50 to 64, the risk reduction was 43% and 40% respectively, and for over 65s, 37% and 43%. The researchers note that the protection against much worse outcomes is probably even greater. What we know from past experience is generally that the vaccines protect better against more severe disease, lead author Ruth Link-Gels tells CNN.com. We would expect that similar estimates for protection against hospitalization and death would be higher. And we're on the Talking Points page. First article is Ukraine, a turning point is coming. A likely escalation looms in Ukraine, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, with Russians bombarding dozens of Ukrainian strongholds on the Eastern Front and trying to capture the ravaged city of Bakhmut. Russian President Vladimir Putin is shrugging off the loss of 200,000 troops and is reportedly poised to send up to 500,000 more soldiers to bolster a new offensive. In response, Ukrainian officials are asking for more Western weaponry, including longer-range missiles and F-16 fighter jets, a request President Biden has rejected thus far. CIA Director William Burns is warning that the war's decisive moment will occur in the next 6 months, and NATO countries are confronted with a dilemma. Should their aim be to simply to allow Ukraine to ensure its survival, or to pursue total victory and the defeat of Russian President Vladimir Putin? Only true Russian defeat on the battlefield will end this war, said Alexander J. Model in The Hill. Putin is clearly committed to an extended war lasting years. Ukraine is just as determined to fight to the finish. To prevent additional years of horrific carnage, the U.S. has to supply Ukraine with all the weapons it needs to win as quickly as possible. Still, we can't dismiss the age-old concerns about escalation, said Daniel DePetris in the Washington Examiner. Putin is fanatically determined to keep Crimea. And if Ukraine used F-16s or long-range missiles to drive Russian forces out of that Black Sea peninsula, it could be his true red line issue, one that could tempt him to use nuclear or chemical weapons. That fear is legitimate, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, but the stakes are so great the West cannot afford to be intimidated. By waging a brutal war of conquest of a peaceful nation, Putin is challenging the post-1945 liberal world order that has largely prevented a third world war. Now he's decided to double down despite horrific battlefield losses and is thus issuing a challenge to Biden and NATO. I can't afford to lose this war, and I will pay any price and bear any burden to ensure that I come away with a slice of Ukraine that can justify my losses. How about you? Year one of this war has been heartbreaking, but year two is going to get scary. Tipping, the annoying new norm. Fed-up consumers are becoming increasingly annoyed about an age-old practice that many say is getting out of hand, said Hallelujah Hadero in the Associated Press. Tipping. With many stores and businesses adopting touchscreens to process payments, there is growing pressure to bestow tips on all kinds of service workers, from the fast food worker at the drive-thru to coffee shop servers to the deli cashier who rings up your bottle of Poland Spring. The screen prompts customers to leave a tip, ranging from 15 to 30%, every time they buy a muffin or a simple cup of coffee. And servers and other customers can watch if you check no tip. The constant social pressure to tip makes you feel bad, said Clarissa Moore, a supervisor at Pennsylvania Utility. You feel like you have to do it. The pandemic helped usher in this new era of generous tipping, said Mike Sutter in the San Antonio Express News. Consumers dug deep to show their gratitude to service workers, risking serious illness to keep serving us. Now we're through the worst of it, but that tip creep has continued. Tips at full-service restaurants were up 25% in the third quarter of 2022 over the previous year, while counter-service tips were up 17%, according to the digital payment company Square. As norms shift, simple transactions have become increasingly awkward for befuddled consumers unsure when to tip and how much, said Nathaniel Meyerson in CNN.com. The worker is standing there watching you need to make a decision in seconds. Oh, Lord, the stress. It might irritate or confuse you, said Grub Street, but you need to deal with these new social expectations. Anything less than 20% for a restaurant server is miserly and rude, whether you like the service or not. At any food counter, you must tip something if prompted, and at a coffee shop or deli, tip at least 20%. Sorry, said Tiana Lowe in the Washington Examiner, but that's beyond the pale. Nobody should be strong-armed into giving 20% to someone who scoops an ice cream cone or pours coffee into a cup. Instead of trying to shame consumers into tipping $3 on an overpriced latte, business owners should pay workers a living wage, not foist the responsibility onto dumbstruck consumers. GOP primary. Trump's many challengers. The only thing certain about the 2024 GOP presidential primary is that it won't be a coronation, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. Weeks after Donald Trump officially declared his candidacy, Nikki Haley, the former South Carolina governor who served as UN ambassador in the Trump administration, plans to announce her candidacy next week. She will join Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Trump's Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as Republicans showing obvious interest in running, along with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin. Although Haley in 2021 said she was disgusted with Trump's behavior after his election defeat, Trump appeared to welcome her candidacy, suggesting he hopes Haley pulls votes from his chief rival, DeSantis. Polls are exceptionally divided on Trump's candidacy, said Nate Kahn in the New York Times, with his support among Republican voters in a multi-candidate field ranging from 55% to 25%. At this early stage, Trump is no front-runner. GOP presidential hopefuls will position themselves as the best alternative to Trump, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. But the more candidates who are crowded into that lane, the likelier Trump is to win the nomination. That's what happened in 2016 when Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Chris Christie diluted the anti-Trump vote, allowing him to win with a mere plurality of the vote. To defeat the reigning champion, someone has to attack Trump, keep attacking Trump, bloody his nose, and then survive the counterpunch. Does anyone have the guts to try? Trump is weakened and vulnerable, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, especially after his often disastrous midterm interventions. Republican leaders fear both a Trump primary victory and a Trump defeat, said Pierre Winner in The Atlantic. Trump won't commit to supporting the GOP nominee if it's not him, and a recent Bulwark poll found that more than a quarter of likely Republican voters are ready to follow Trump to a third-party bid, which would be catastrophic for the GOP. He might also keep attacking the Republican nominee, signaling to his supporters that they should sit out the election. Trump is an arsonist who delights in watching the world burn. If Republicans cast him aside, he is likely to turn on them, filled with the burning rage of a thousand suns. Here are a few of the shorter notes. A task force set up by the Biden administration is in the process of reunifying 148 children with families separated at the border during the Trump administration and has contacted another 183 families to say reunification is possible. But the families of 667 migrant children have not been located thus far. Republican Representative Andrew Clyde of Georgia has upset some Democrats by handing out lapel pins to colleagues depicting AR-15 assault rifles, which numerous GOP lawmakers wore during National Gun Violence Survivors Week. Clyde, who owns a gun store, said he was giving the pins out to remind people how important the Second Amendment is in preserving our liberties. Half of the 60 black legislators elected to Congress this year represent states or districts with a plurality of white voters. For decades, African-American politicians were elected mainly in majority black districts. The coldest wind chill ever recorded in the U.S., minus 108 degrees Fahrenheit, was measured atop New Hampshire's Mount Washington on February 3rd. A temperature of minus 46 degrees combined with wind gusts of 127 miles per hour. In northern Maine, there were frost quakes, explosive noises, and shaking that occurred when moisture in the ground rapidly freezes and expands. On the poll watch, 56% of Americans believe a new House subcommittee charged with investigating federal law enforcement's treatment of conservatives is just an attempt to score political points. 36% say it's a legitimate investigation. Just 37% of Democrats want President Biden to seek a second term in office, a big drop from 52% right after the midterm elections. And a number of interesting quotes this week. We've got time for several. We'll start with Salman Rushdie, who says, "Bad times traditionally produce good books." Writer Annika J. Green says, "If you are not consciously building your habits, they are unconsciously building you." And finally, economist Theodore Levitt says, "People don't want to buy a quarter-inch drill. They want a quarter-inch hole." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.